hands of the Shonchan. The slim woman looked uncharacteristically disheveled. Her hair was pulled back in a serviceable bun, and her pale dress was wrinkled. The last woman in the room was Sarancha Colveen, head clerk of the Grey Aja. She had light brown hair and a pinched face. She looked perpetually as if she'd tasted something very sour. The trait seemed more manifest today than usual.
"She has a point, Jessie," Farana said, her logical tone a contrast with her obvious pique. "You were the one to suggest this course of action."
"Suggest is a strong word." Jessie took a sip of her drink.
"I simply mentioned that in some of the more private tower records, there are accounts of times when the Aja heads ruled instead of the Amarlin."
The 13th depository was known to the Aja heads, though they could not visit it unless they were also sitters. That didn't stop most of them from sending sitters to gather information from it for them.
"I may have been the messenger, but that is often the role of the Brown. You all were not so hesitant as to be forced into this course of action."
There were a few sideways glances at that, and the women found opportunity to study their tea. Yes, they were all implicated, and they understood it. Jessie would not take the blame for this disaster.
"There is little use in assigning blame."
Swana attempted to be soothing, though her voice was laced with bitterness.
"I won't be deflected so easily," Adalorna growled.
Some reacted to the loss of a warder with sadness, others with anger. There was little doubt which was Adalorna's way.
"A grave, grave error has been made. The White Tower burns, the Amarlin has been captured by invaders, and the Dragon Reborn still walks the earth unfettered. The entire world will soon know of our disgrace."
"And what good will it do to blame one another?" Suana replied.
"Are we so childish that we will spend this meeting squabbling about which one of us will hang in a useless attempt to evade our responsibility?"
Jessie gave quiet thanks for the bony yellow's words. Of course, Suana had been the first of the Aja heads to agree to Jessie's plan, so she'd be next in line for the metaphorical hanging.
"She has a point." Sarancha took a sip of her tea. "We must make peace among ourselves. The tower needs leadership, and we're not going to get it from the hall."
"That's partly our fault as well," Farana admitted, looking sick.
It was. It had seemed like a brilliant plan. The division of the tower, the departure of so many in rebellion, and the raising of a new Amarlin had not been their fault, but it had presented several opportunities. The first had been the easiest to take hold of. Send sitters to the rebels to steer them and hasten a reconciliation. The most youthful of sitters had been chosen. Their replacements in the tower intended to serve only a short time. The Aja heads had been certain this ripple of a rebellion could be easily smoothed over. They hadn't taken it seriously enough. That had been their first mistake. The second was more dire. There were indeed times in the past where the Aja heads, not the Amarlin seat or the Hall of the Tower, had led the Aes Sedai. It had been done secretly, of course, but it had been very successful. Why, the reign of Samaila Sorenthane would have been a complete disaster if the Aja heads hadn't stepped in. This had seemed like a similar occasion. The days of the last battle's approach were a special time, requiring special attention. Attention from women of sound, rational minds and great experience. Women who could speak together in confidence and decide on the best course, avoiding the arguments that the hall got into.
"Where did we go wrong, do you think?"
Sarancha asked quietly. The women fell silent. None of them wanted to admit outright that the plan had backfired. Adalorna settled back in her chair, arms folded, smoldering but no longer flinging out accusations.
"It was Elida," Farana said. "She wasn't ever very logical."
"She was a bloody disaster is what she was," Adalorna muttered.
"It was more than that," Jessie admitted. "Directly choosing sitters we could control to replace those sent to the rebels was a good decision, but perhaps too obvious.
The women of our own Ajahs became suspicious. I know of several comments made by women of the Brown. We are not so oblivious as others would like to think us.
Sarancha nodded.
It smelled of conspiracy, she said. That made the women less trusting. And then there were the rebels. Far more difficult to control than presumed.
The women nodded.
They, like Jesse, had assumed that with proper direction, the rebels would find their way back to the tower and ask forgiveness. This division should have ended with no more damage than a few bruised egos. But they hadn't counted on how resilient or effective the rebels would be. A full army, appearing on the shores around Tarvalen in the middle of a snowstorm? Led by one of the greatest military minds of the age? With a new Amarlin and a frustratingly effective siege? Who could have expected it? And some of the sitters they had sent had begun siding with the rebels more than the White Tower.
We never should have let Elida disband the Blue Aja, Jesse thought. The Blues might have been willing to come back had it not happened. But it was such a dishonor that they dug in.
Light only knew how dangerous that was. The histories were filled with accounts of how dogged the Blues could be at getting their way, particularly when they were forced into a corner. I think it is time to admit that there is no hope to save our plans, Suana said.
Are we agreed?
Agreed,
Adalorna said. One by one, the sisters nodded their heads, and so did Jessie herself. Even in this room, it was difficult to admit fault, but it was time to cut their losses and begin rebuilding.
This has its own problems, Sarancha said, voice more calm now.
The other women looked more assured as well. They didn't trust one another, these five, but they were far closer to doing so than any other group with any authority in the hall.
Care must be taken, Farana added. The division must be mended.
The rebellion was against Elida, Adalorna said. If she is no longer Amarlin, then what is there to rebel against?
So we abandon her? Jesse asked.
She deserves it, Adalorna said.
She said time and time again that Shan Chen were no threat. Well, now she is paying for her foolishness firsthand.
Elida is beyond rescue, Farana added. The hall has already discussed this. The Amarlin is buried somewhere in a mass of Shan Chen captives, and we have neither the resources nor the information for a rescue.
Not to mention our total lack of desire, Jessie added to herself. Many of the sitters who had brought these points before the hall were ones who had been sent to penance by Elida. Jessie wasn't one of those, but she did agree that Elida had earned her reward, if only for the way she had driven the Ajahs to one another's throats.
Then we need a replacement, Sarancha said.
But who?
It has to be someone strong, Suana said. But someone cautious, unlike Elida. Someone whom the sisters can rally around.
What about Sayer in Asnabar? Jessie asked. She has shown uncanny wisdom of late, and she is well liked.
Of course you'd choose a Brown, Adalorna said.
And why not? Jessie said, taken aback.
You all heard, I think, how well she did assuming command during the attack last night?
Cian Harriman led her own pocket of resistance, Farana said. I should think this would be a time for a woman to lead who is of an unemotional temperament. Someone who can provide rational guidance.
Nonsense, Suana said. Whites are too emotionless. We don't want to alienate sisters. We want to bring them together.
Heal them.
Why, a yellow...
You're all forgetting something, Sarancha interjected.
What is needed now? A reconciliation. The Grey Aja is the one that has spent centuries practicing the art of negotiation. Who better to deal with the divided tower and the Dragon Reborn himself?
Adalorna gripped the armrests of her chair and straightened her back. The others were growing tense as well. As Adalorna opened her mouth to speak, Jessie cut her off.
Enough, she interjected. Are we just going to squabble as the hall has been doing all morning? Each Aja offering its own members and the others summarily rejecting them?
The room fell silent again. It was true. The hall had been in session for hours, and had only just gone into a short recess. No one Aja was close to getting enough support for one of its candidates. The sitters would not stand for anyone not of their own Aja. There was too much animosity between them. Light, but this was a mess.
Ideally, it should be one of us five, Farana said. That makes sense.
The five looked at each other, and Jesse could read their answers to that in their eyes. They were the Aja heads, the most powerful women in the world. Right now they were balanced in power, and while they trusted each other more than most, there was no way any of them would allow the elevation of another Aja head to the Amarlin seat. It would give the woman far too much power. After the failure of their plan, trust was wearing very thin.
If we don't decide soon, Suana noted, the Hall may take the decision from us.
Bah! Adelorna waved a hand. They're so divided they can't agree on what color the sky is. The sitters have no idea what they're doing.
At least some of us didn't choose sitters who were years too young to be placed in the Hall, Farana said.
Oh, Adelorna said. And you got around that how, Farana? By choosing yourself as a sitter? Farana's eyes widened with rage. It was not a good idea to rile that woman's temper.
We all make mistakes, Jesse said quickly. Many sisters we chose were odd. We wanted women who would do exactly as we said. But instead we got a group of squabbling brats with inflated opinions of themselves, too immature for more temperate minds to influence.
Adelorna and Farana made a point of not looking at each other.
This still leaves us with a problem, Suana said. We need an Amarlin. Healing must begin quickly, whatever the cost.
Sarancha shook her head.
I honestly can't think of a single woman that a sufficient number of sitters would support.
I can, Adelorna said softly. She was mentioned in the Hall several times today.
You know of whom I speak. She is young and her circumstances are unusual, but everything is unusual at the moment.
I don't know, Suana said, frowning.
She was mentioned, yes, but by those whose motives I don't trust.
Saren seems quite taken with her, Jesse admitted.
She's too young, Sarancha said. Weren't we just berating ourselves for choosing sitters who lacked the necessary experience?
She is young, yes, Farana noted. But you have to admit, there's a certain flair to her. I hardly think that anyone in the tower stood up to Elida as effectively as she, and while in such a position as she was, no less.
You've heard the reports of her actions during the attack, Adelorna said. I can confirm that they are true. I was there with her for most of it.
Jesse started at this. She hadn't realized that Adelorna had been on the 22nd level during the fighting.
Surely some of what was said is exaggeration.
Adelorna shook her head grimly.
No, it isn't. It sounds incredible, but it... Well, it happened. All of it.
The novices all but worship her, Farana said. If the sitters will not stand for someone of another Aja, what of a woman who never picked an Aja? A woman who has some experience, however unjustified, in holding the very position we are discussing?
Jessie found herself nodding.
But how had the young rebel gained such respect from Farana and Adelorna?
I am uncertain, Suana said. It seems like another rash decision.
Didn't you yourself say that we had to heal the tower, no matter what the cost? Adelorna asked. Can you honestly think of a better way to bring the rebels back to us?
She turned to Sarancha.
What is the best method of appeasing an offended party? Would it not be to give some ground to them? Acknowledge what they have done right?
She has a point, Suana admitted.
She grimaced, then downed the rest of her tea in one gulp.
Light, but she's right, Sarancha. We have to do it.
The Grey looked at each of them in turn.
You aren't foolish enough to assume this woman will be led by the nose, are you? I won't stand for this if we're simply trying to create another puppet. That plan failed. It failed miserably.
I doubt we'll find ourselves in that situation again, Farana said, smiling faintly.
This one is not the type to be bullied. Just look at how she dealt with Elida's restrictions.
Yes, Jessie found herself saying, to her own surprise. Sisters, if we agree to this, it will end our dream of ruling from the shadows. For better or worse, we'll be setting up an Ammerlin of strength.
I, for one, Adalorna said, think that's a splendid idea. It's been too long.
One by one, the others agreed. Swan stood, unmoving, beneath the boughs of a small oak. The tree had been engulfed by the camp, and its shade had become a favored location for accepted and novices taking lunches. There were none doing so at the moment. The sisters, showing remarkably good judgment this time, had set them tasks to keep them from congregating around the tent where the hall was meeting. And so Swan stood alone, watching as Shiriam pulled the flaps to the large pavilion closed. She was able to attend now that Egwene was back. It was easy to sense when the ward against eavesdropping was woven, sealing the meeting to the flame. A hand fell on Swan's shoulder. She didn't jump. She'd sensed Bryn approaching. The general walked with stealth, although there was no need. He was going to make an excellent warder. He stepped up beside her, hand still comfortably on her shoulder, and she allowed herself the luxury of taking just a small step closer to him. His height and sturdiness felt good beside her, like knowing that though the sky stormed and the sea raged, your hull was caulked, and your sail crafted of the strongest cloth.
"What do you think she will tell them?" Bryn asked, his voice subdued.
"I honestly have no idea. She could call for my stilling, I suppose."
"I doubt that she will," Bryn asked. "She is not the vengeful type. Besides, she knows that you did what you felt you had to, for her own good."
Swan grimaced. "Nobody likes being disobeyed, least of all the Ammerlin. I will pay for last night, Bryn. You're right that it probably won't be in a public way, but I worry that I've lost the girl's trust."
"And was it worth the cost?"
"Yes," Swan said. "She didn't realize how close this band was to slipping away from her, and we couldn't know that she'd be safe within the tower during the attack. If there's one thing my time in the White Tower taught me, it's that there is a time for gathering and planning, but one also has to act. You can't always wait for certainty." She could feel Bryn's smile through the bond. Light, but it was good to have a warder again. She hadn't realized how much she'd missed that comforting knot of emotions in the back of her mind, that stability. Men thought differently from women, and things she found complicated and baffling, Bryn saw as straightforward and simple. Make your decision and go. There was a helpful clarity to his way of reasoning. Not that he was simple. Just less inclined to regret decisions he'd already made.
"And what of the other costs?" Bryn added.
She could feel his hesitation, his worry. She turned to him, smiling in amusement. "You're a fool, Gareth Bryn." He frowned. "Bonding you was never a cost," she said. "Whatever else happens because of this fiasco, that aspect of the night's events was pure profit on my part." He chuckled.
"Well, I'll have to make extra certain that my second demand is more unreasonable, then."
Fish guts, Swan thought. She'd almost forgotten about that.
Burning unlikely that Bryn would, though. "And when, precisely, are you going to make this unreasonable demand of me?"
He didn't respond immediately, instead looking down at her, rubbing his chin.
"You know," he said, "I think I actually understand you now, Swan Sanche. You are a woman of honor. It's just that nobody else's requirements of you can ever be more harsh or more demanding than your own requirements of yourself. You owe such a self-imposed debt to your own sense of duty that I doubt any mortal being could pay it back."
"You make me sound centered on myself," she said.
"At least I'm not comparing you to a boar again."
"So you do think I'm self-centered," she said. Burn him. He could probably sense that she was actually bothered by his statement, rather than making arguments for the sake of it. Burn him again.
"You're a driven woman, Swan Sanche," he said. "Driven to save the world from itself. That's how you can shrug off an oath or an order so easily.
Swan took a deep breath.
This conversation grew very tedious very quickly, Gareth Bryn. Are you going to tell me that other demand, or are you going to make me wait?
He studied her stone face thoughtfully.
Well, frankly, I'm planning to demand that you marry me.
She blinked in surprise. Light, the bond said that he was honest.
But only after you feel the world can care for itself. I won't agree to it before then, Swan. You've given your life to something. I'll see that you survive through it. I hope that once you're done, you'll be willing to give your life to something else instead.
She reined in her shock. She wouldn't let a fool man make her speechless.
Well, she forced herself to say, I see you have some sense after all. We shall see if I agree to this demand of yours or not. I will think on it.
Bryn chuckled as she turned around to regard the pavilion, waiting for Egwene's reappearance. He could sense the truth from inside her, just as she could sense it from him. Light! Now she knew why Greens married their warders so often. Feeling his affection for her while she felt the same for him made her giddy. He was a fool of a man, and she no less a fool of a woman. She shook her head ruefully, but she did let herself lean back against him softly as they waited, and he replaced his hand on her shoulder. Soft, not forceful, willing to wait. He did understand her. Egwene stood before a group of smooth faces that were far too good at hiding their anxiety. By custom, she had ordered Quamesa to weave the ward against eavesdropping, as the sharp-nosed Grey was the youngest among the sitters in the large tent. It looked almost empty with so few places taken. A dozen women, two from each Aja. There would have been three of each, but the Ajas had all sent one sitter with the envoy to the Black Tower. The Greys had already replaced Delana with Naurisa Cambral. 12 sitters, along with Egwene and one other. Egwene did not look at Shiriam, who sat in her place to the side. Shiriam had seemed troubled as she entered. Did she realize what Egwene knew? She couldn't. If she had, she'd never have come to the meeting. Still, knowing she was there and knowing what she was made Egwene nervous. In the chaos of the Seanchan attack, Swan hadn't been able to watch Shiriam. Why did the keeper wear a bandage on her left hand? Egwene didn't believe her excuse of an accident while riding, her little finger getting caught in her reins. Why had she refused healing? Blast, Swan. Instead of watching Shiriam, she'd come to kidnap Egwene. The hall grew still, the women waiting to see what Egwene's response would be to her freedom. Romanda, gray-streaked hair up in a bun, sat primly in a yellow dress. She oozed satisfaction, while Lilaine, on the opposite side of the room, sulked while trying to act pleased at Egwene's return. After what Egwene had been through in the White Tower, this squabbling felt ridiculously petty. Egwene took a deep breath, then embraced the source. It felt so good. No bitter fork root to squeeze her power to a trickle. No need to reach through other women to lend her strength. No need for a Sa'angreal. Sweet though the Fluted One's power had been, being strong in and of herself was even more satisfying. Several of the women frowned at the action, and not a few of them embraced the source themselves, as if by reflex, looking about as if for danger. "There will be no need for that," Egwene said to the women. "Not yet. Please release the source." They were hesitant, but, ostensibly, they accepted her as Amarlin. One by one their power winked away. Egwene did not release it herself. "I'm very glad to see that you returned safely, Mother," Lilaine said. She skirted the three oaths by adding the word safely. "Thank you," Egwene said calmly. "You said that there were important revelations to make," Varalyn added. "Is this regarding the Seanchan attack?" Egwene reached to the pouch on her skirt and pulled its contents free. A smooth white rod with the numeral 3 inscribed on it in the script of the Age of Legends near the base. There were several gasps. Egwene wove spirit into the rod, then spoke in a clear voice. I vow that I will speak no word that is not true. She felt the oath fall over her like a physical thing, her skin growing tighter, prickling. It was easy to ignore. The pain was nothing compared with what she had been through. I vow that I will make no weapon for one man to kill another. I vow that I will never use the one power as a weapon except against dark friends and shadow spawn, or in the last extreme of defending my life, or that of my warder, or of another sister. The hall was silent. Egwene released her weave. Her skin felt so odd, as if someone had pinched the excess up at the base of her neck and along her spine, yanking it and binding it in place. Let it no longer be thought that I can avoid keeping the three oaths, Egwene announced. Let it no longer be breathed that I am not fully Aes Sedai. None of them said anything about her not having taken the test to gain the shawl. She would see to that another day. And now that you've seen me use the oath rod and know that I cannot lie, I will tell you something. During my time in the White Tower, a sister came to me and confided that she was Black Aja. The women's eyes bulged, and several gasped quietly. Yes, Egwene said. I know we don't like to speak of them, but can any of us honestly claim that the Black Aja does not exist? Can you hold to the oaths while saying that you've never considered the possibility, even the likelihood, of there being dark friends among us? Nobody dared to. The tent felt hot, despite the early hour. Stuffy. None of them sweated, of course. They knew the age-old trick of avoiding that. Yes, Egwene said. It is shameful, but it is a truth that we, as the leaders of our people, must admit. Not in public, but among ourselves there is no avoiding it. I have seen firsthand what distrust and quiet politicking can do to a people. I will not see the same disease infect us here. We are of different Ajas, but we are single in purpose. We need to know that we can trust one another implicitly, because there is very little else in the world that can be trusted. Egwene looked down at the oath rod, which she'd fetched early in the morning from Saeron. She rubbed her thumb on it. I wish you'd been able to find this when you visited Verin, she thought. Perhaps it wouldn't have saved you, but I would have liked to try. I could use your aid. Egwene looked up. I am not a dark friend, she announced to the room. And you know it cannot be a lie. The sitters looked perplexed. Well, they would soon see the point. It is time for us to prove ourselves, Egwene said. Some clever women in the White Tower hit upon this idea, and I intend to expand it. We will each in turn use the oath rod to release ourselves from the three oaths, then re-swear them in turn. Once we are all bound, we will be able to promise that we are not servants of... Shiriam embraced the source. Egwene had been anticipating that. She slammed a shield between Shiriam and the source, causing the woman to gasp. Barana cried out in shock, and several other women embraced the source, looking this way and that. Egwene turned and met Shiriam's eyes. The woman's face was nearly as red as her hair, and she was breathing in and out quickly. Like a captured rabbit, its leg in a snare, eyes wide with fright. She clutched her bandaged hand. Oh, Shiriam, Egwene thought. I had hoped that Verin was wrong about you. Egwene? Shiriam asked uncomfortably. I was just... Egwene stepped forward. Are you Black Aja, Shiriam? What? Of course not. Do you consort with the Forsaken? No, Shiriam said, glancing to the sides. Do you serve the Dark One? No. Have you been released from your oaths? No. Do you have red hair? Of course not. I never... She froze. And thank you for that trick as well, Verin, Egwene thought with a mental sigh. The tent grew very, very still. I misspoke, of course, Shiriam said, sweating nervously. I didn't know what question I was answering. I can't lie, of course, none of us can. She trailed off as Egwene held out the oath rod. Prove it, Shiriam. The woman who came to me in the tower gave me your name as a leader among the Black Aja. Shiriam met Egwene's eyes. Ah, then, the woman said softly, eyes mournful. Who was it now who came to you?
Varin Mathwin.
Well, well, Shiriam said, settling back on her chair. Never expected it of her, I'll say. How did she get past the oaths to the great lord?
She drank poison, Egwene said, heart-twisting.
Very clever. The flame-haired woman nodded. I could never bring myself to do such a thing. Never indeed.
Egwene wove bonds of air and wrapped Shiriam in them, then tied off the weaves. She turned back to an incredulous group of women, white-faced, some terrified.
The world marches to the last battle, Egwene said sternly. Did you expect that our enemies would leave us alone?
Who else? Lilaine whispered. Who else was mentioned?
Many others, Egwene said. Sitters among them.
Moria leaped to her feet and ran for the exit. She barely made it 2 steps. A dozen different sisters enclosed the former blue with shields and bound her in weaves of air. In seconds she was hanging, gagged, tears leaking down the sides of her oval face.
Romanda clicked her tongue, walking around the woman. Both from the blue, she noted. This was a dramatic way to make the revelations, Egwene.
You will address me as Mother, Romanda, Egwene said, walking down from the dais. And it is not so odd that there would be a higher percentage of them among the blue here, since that entire Aja fled the White Tower.
She held up the oath rod.
The reason I had to make the revelation this way was simple. How would you have responded if I'd simply declared them to be black without offering proof?
Romanda nodded her head.
You are correct on both counts, Mother, she admitted.
Then you wouldn't mind being the first to retake the oaths, I presume?
Romanda hesitated only briefly, glancing at the 2 women bound in air. Almost everyone in the room held on to the source, eyeing the others as if they might grow copper snakes for hair at any moment.
Romanda took the oath rod and did as instructed, releasing herself from the oaths. The process was obviously painful, but she held herself to a controlled, hissing intake of breath. The others watched carefully for a trick, but Romanda was straightforward in re-swearing. She handed the rod back to Egwene.
I'm not a dark friend, she said. And I never have been.
Egwene accepted the oath rod back.
Thank you, Romanda, she said. Lilaine, do you wish to be next?
Gladly, the woman said.
She probably felt a need to vindicate the blue. One by one the other women forswore, gasping or hissing at the pain of it, then swore again and promised that they were not dark friends. Egwene let out a silent sigh of relief at each one. Varin had admitted that there would be sisters she didn't get, and that Egwene might discover other members of the Black among the sitters. When Kwamesa, the last, handed the rod back to Egwene and declared herself not a dark friend, there was a visible release of tension in the room.
Very good, Egwene said, returning to stand at the head of the room. From now on, we continue as one. No more squabbling. No more fighting. We each have the best interests of the White Tower and the world itself at heart. The 12 of us at least are confident in one another. A cleansing is never easy. It is often painful. Today we have cleansed ourselves, but what we have to do next will be nearly as painful.
You know the names of many others? Takima asked, for once looking not a bit distracted.
Yes, Egwene said. Over 200 total, some from each Aja. Some 70 among us here in this camp. I have the names.
She had returned in the night to fetch Varin's books from her room. They were now safely hidden in her tent, invisible.
I propose that we arrest them, though it will be difficult, as we will have to seize all of them as simultaneously as possible.
Their greatest advantage, beyond surprise, was going to be the inherently distrusting nature of the Black Aja. Varin and other sources had indicated that few sisters in the Black knew more than a handful of other names. There was an entire write-up in the book about Black Aja organization, and their system of groups known as hearts that had minimal interaction to keep them hidden. Hopefully that very system would slow their realizing what was happening. The sitters looked daunted. First, Egwene said, we will claim that we need to spread important news to every sister, but can't let it be overheard by the soldiers in camp. We'll call the sisters into this pavilion by Aja. It's big enough to hold about 200 people. I'll distribute to each of you the names of all the Black Sisters. When each Aja enters, I'll repeat to them what I told you and tell them they're all going to have to re-swear on the oath rod. We'll be ready to seize Black Sisters who try to escape. We'll tie them up and deposit them in the audience tent. That smaller tent was connected to the side of the hall and could be closed off so that entering sisters wouldn't see the captives. We'll have to do something about warders, Lilaine said grimly. Let them come in with their sisters, I suppose, and be prepared to seize them. Some of them will be dark friends, Egwene said, but not all, and I don't know which ones. Verin had had some notes about this, but not many, unfortunately.
Light, what a mess, Ramonda muttered. It must be done, haughty Barana said with a shake of her head.
And it must be done quickly, Egwene said, so that the Black Sisters don't have time to escape. I'll warn Lord Bryn to create a perimeter of archers and sisters we trust to stop any trying to escape, just in case. But that will only work for those too weak to make gateways.
We mustn't let it come to that, Lilaine said. A war inside the camp itself, Egwene nodded.
And what of the White Tower? Lilaine said. Once we have cleansed ourselves, Egwene said, then we can do what must be done to reunify the Aes Sedai.
You mean, yes, Lilaine, Egwene said.
I mean to begin an assault on Tar Valon by this evening. Pass the word and tell Lord Bryn to prepare his men. The news will serve to distract the Black members among us, and will make them less likely to notice what we are doing.
Ramonda glanced at Shiriam and Moria, hanging in the air at the side of the tent, both weeping openly, mouths bound with gags of air.
It must be done. I put forth a motion before the hall to take the action the Amyrlin has suggested.
The tent grew still. Then slowly each woman rose to give consensus. It was unanimous.
Light preserve us, Lilaine whispered. And forgive us for what we are about to do.
My thoughts exactly, Egwene added.
Chapter 44 Sense Unknown.
Tarwyn's Gap is the place that makes the most sense, Nynaeve argued. She and Rand rode on an overgrown road in the open grassland of Maredo, accompanied by a crowd of Aiel. Nynaeve was the only Aes Sedai there. Narishma and Naif rode near the back of the group, looking sullen. Rand had forced their Aes Sedai to stay behind. He seemed particularly determined to assert his independence from them lately. Nynaeve was astride a pure white mare named Moonlight, appropriated from Rand's stable in Tyr. It still seemed odd that he would have his own stable at all, let alone one in each of the major cities of the world.
Tarwyn's Gap, Rand said, shaking his head.
No. The more I think about it, the more I realize that we don't want to fight there. Lan is doing me a favor. If I can coordinate an assault alongside his own, I can gain great advantage. But I don't want to distract my armies with the Gap. It would be a waste of resources.
A waste of resources? The Gap was where Lan was heading, like an arrow loosed from a Two Rivers longbow, heading there to die. And Rand said helping was a waste? Wool-headed fool!
Gritting her teeth, she forced herself to calm down. If only he would argue, rather than speaking in that distant way he had recently adopted. He seemed so emotionless, but she had seen the beast get free and roar at her. It was coiled inside him, and if he didn't let his emotions out soon, they would devour him from the inside. But how to make him see reason? She had prepared argument after argument, each of them distinctly reasoned and calmly explained during their time in Tyr. Rand had ignored all of them, spending the last 2 days meeting with his generals
and planning strategy for the last battle. Each day brought Lan one step closer to a fight he couldn't win. Each day made her more anxious. Several times she'd nearly abandoned Rand and ridden for the north. If Lan was going to fight an impossible battle, then she longed to be at his side. But she stayed. Light take Randall Thor, she stayed. What good would it do to help Lan, only to let the world fall into shadow because of a stubborn sheepherder's stubbornness? She gave her braid a solid yank. The jeweled bracelets and rings on her hands glittered in the faint sunlight. The sky was cloudy, of course, just as it had been for weeks. Everyone tried to ignore how unnatural that was, but Nynaeve could still feel that storm building to the north. Such a short time left until Lan reached the gap. Light sensed that he was slowed down by the Malkieri who had come to support him in his ride. Light sensed that he was not alone. Thinking of him, riding into the Blight, facing the army of Shadow Spawn who infested his homeland. "We have to attack there," Nynaeve said. "Aitoralda says that the Blight is swarming with Trollocs. The Dark One is gathering his forces. You can bet that the bulk of them will be at the Gap, where it's easiest to get through and strike at Andor and Kyrian."
"That is exactly why we will not attack at the Gap, Nynaeve," Rand said, voice cold and even. "We cannot let the enemy dictate our battlefield. The last thing we want to do is fight where they want us to, or where they expect us to."
He turned eyes northward.
"Yes, let them gather. They seek me, and I shall not deliver myself. Why fight at Tarwyn's Gap? It makes the best sense to jump most of our armies right to Sheol Ghul."
"Rand," she said, trying to sound reasonable. Couldn't he see that she was reasonable?
"There is no way that Lan has been able to gather a large enough force to hold back a mass assault by the Trollocs, particularly not with most of the Borderlander armies doing light only knows what down here. He'll be overrun, and the Trollocs will invade."
Mention of the Borderlanders made Rand's face tighten. They rode to meet with one of their messengers.
"The Trollocs will invade," Rand repeated.
"Yes."
"Good," Rand said. "It will keep them occupied as I do what needs to be done."
"And Lan?" Nynaeve asked.
"His attack will be well placed," Rand nodded. "He will draw my enemy's attention to Malkier and the Gap, and it will make them think that I am there. Shadow Spawn can't move through gateways, so they can't move as quickly as I can. By the time they've engaged Lan, I'll be past them and attacking directly at the Dark One's heart. I don't plan to abandon the southern lands, not at all. When the Trollocs punch through the Gap, they will break up into fists to invade. That's when my forces will hit them, led by Bashir, traveling by gateway to strike at each group of Trollocs from the sides or behind. That way we can pick the best battlefields to suit our needs."
"Rand," Nynaeve said, her anger fading to horror. "Lan will die."
"Then who am I to deny him that?" Rand said. "We all deserve the chance to find peace."
Nynaeve found her mouth hanging open. He actually believed that.
Or he was convincing himself to believe it, at least. "My duty is to kill the Dark One," Rand said, as if to himself. "I kill him, then I die. That is all."
"But that is enough, Nynaeve." Rand spoke softly in that dangerous voice of his. He would not be pressed further. Nynaeve sat back, stewing, trying to decide how to press him on the topic. Light. He would leave the people of the Borderlands to suffer and die in the Trolloc invasions. The people there wouldn't care if the Dark One had been defeated. They would be cooking in stew pots. That would leave Lan and the Malkieri to fight alone, a tiny force to resist the might of every monster that the Blight could spit out. The Shan Shan would wage their war to the south and the west. The Trollocs would attack from the north and the east. The two would meet, eventually. Andor and the other kingdoms would be turned into a massive battleground. The people there, good people like those in the Two Rivers, would have no chance against such warfare. They'd be crushed. So what could she do to change it? She had to come up with a new strategy to influence Rand.
Everything in her heart pointed at protecting Lan. She had to get him help. The group rode through open grassland, spotted occasionally with farms. They passed one on the right, a solitary farmstead not unlike many back in the Two Rivers. Yet, in the Two Rivers, she'd never seen a farmer watch travelers with such open hostility. The red-bearded man in dirtied trousers, with sleeves rolled nearly to his shoulders, leaned against a half-finished fence, his axe laid casually but very visibly on the logs beside him. His field had seen better years. Though the soil had been neatly plowed and harrowed, the furrows had spat forth only the smallest of sprouts. The field was spotted with empty patches where seeds had inexplicably refused to take root, and the plants that were growing had a yellowish cast to them. A group of younger men were pulling a stump free from a neighboring field, yet to Nynaeve's practiced eye, they weren't actually trying to get any work done. They didn't have the harness hooked to their ox, and they hadn't loosened the stump in the earth by digging about it. Those lengths of wood lying in the grass were too stout and smoothly worked to be the shafts of tools. Quarterstaffs. It was almost an amusing display, considering the fact that Rand had 200 Aiel with him. But it said something. These men expected trouble and were preparing for it. No doubt they could feel the storm themselves. This area, close to trade routes and within reach of Tyr, was relatively safe from bandits. It was also just far enough north to avoid being caught in squabbles between Ilion and Tyr. This should have been a place where farmers didn't need to turn good lumber into quarterstaffs, nor watch strangers with eyes that expected attack. That wariness would serve them well when the Trollocs reached them, assuming the Seanchan hadn't conquered them and pressed them into their armies by that point. Nynaeve tugged her braid again. Her mind turned back to Lan. She had to do something, but Rand wasn't seeing sense. That left only Cadswain's mysterious plan. Fool woman, refusing to explain it. Nynaeve had made the first step, offering an allegiance. And how had Cadswain reacted? With presumptuous arrogance, of course. How dare she welcome Nynaeve into her little group of Aes Sedai, like a child who has been wandering in the woods? How would Nynaeve's task, discovering where Perrin was, help Lan? During the past week, Nynaeve had pressed Cadswain for more information, but had failed. "Perform this task well, child," Cadswain had said, "and perhaps we shall give you more responsibility in the future. You've proven yourself willful at times, and we can't have that." Nynaeve sighed. Find out where Perrin was. How was she supposed to do that? The Two Rivers folk had been of little use. Many of their men were traveling with Perrin, but they hadn't been seen for some time. They were in the south somewhere, Altara or Gildan, likely, but that left a large area to search. She should have known that the Two Rivers would not provide an easy answer. Cadswain had obviously already tried reaching Perrin herself, and must have failed. That's why she'd given the task to Nynaeve. Had Rand sent Perrin on some secret mission? "Rand," she said. He was muttering roughly to himself. She shivered. "Rand," she said more sharply. He stopped muttering, then glanced at her. She thought she could see the anger hidden there, deep within him, a flash of annoyance at her interruption. Then it was gone, replaced by the frighteningly cool control. "Yes?" he asked. "Do you know where Perrin is?" "He has tasks set before him and performs them," Rand said, turning away. "Why do you wish to know?" "Best not to mention Cadswain. I'm still worried about him. And about Matt." "Ah," Rand said. "You are particularly unaccustomed to lying, aren't you, Nynaeve?" She felt her face flush in embarrassment. When had he learned to read people so well? "I am worried about him, Randalthor," she said. "He has a peaceful, unassuming nature, and always did let his friends push him around too much." "There, let Rand think about that." "Unassuming," Rand said musingly. "Yes, I suppose he is still that. But peaceful?
Perrin is no longer too peaceful.
So he had been in touch with Perrin recently.
Light!
How had Cadswain known, and how had Nynaeve missed those communications?
Rand, if you have Perrin working on something for you, then why have you kept it secret?
I deserve to—
I haven't been meeting with him, Nynaeve, Rand said. Calm yourself. There are simply things that I know. We are connected, Perrin, myself, and Matt.
How? What do you—
That is all I will say on it, Nynaeve, Rand interrupted, slicing into her sentence with soft words.
Nynaeve settled back, gritting her teeth again. The other Aes Sedai spoke of being in control of their emotions, but obviously they didn't have to deal with Randall Thor.
Nynaeve could be calm, too, if she weren't expected to manage the most bull-headed fool of a man who had ever put on a pair of boots.
They rode in silence for a time, the overcast sky hanging above them like a distant field of gray moss peat. The meeting place with the Borderlanders was a nearby crossroads. They could have traveled directly there, but the maidens had prevailed upon Rand to arrive a short distance out and approach more carefully. Traveling was extremely convenient, but it also could be dangerous. If your enemies knew where you would appear, you could open a gateway and find yourself ambushed by a line of archers. Even sending scouts through the gateway first wasn't as safe as traveling to a spot where nobody was expecting you. The Aiel learned and adapted quickly. Surprising, really. The waste was terribly unvaried. Every part looked just about the same. Of course, she had overheard some Aiel guards saying something similar about the wetlands. This particular crossroads hadn't been important in years. If Verin or one of the other Brown sisters had been there, they'd likely have been able to explain exactly why. All Nynaeve knew was that the kingdom which had once held this land had fallen long ago, and the only remnant was the independent city of Far Madding. The wheel of time turned. The most grand of kingdoms fell, rusted, and eventually changed into lazy fields, ruled only by farmers, determined to grow a particularly good crop of barley. It had happened to Manetharan, and it had happened here. Great highways that had once transported legions now dwindled to obscure country roads in need of maintenance. As they continued, Nynaeve let moonlight fall back from Rand's position. That placed her riding near Narishma, with his dark braided hair, bells tinkling on the ends. He wore black, like most Ashaman, and the sword and dragon twinkled on his collar. He'd changed in the months since being bonded as a warder. She could no longer look at him and see a boy. This was a man, with the grace of a soldier, the careful eyes of a warder. A man who had seen death and fought forsaken.
"You're a borderlander, Narishma," Nynaeve said. "Do you have any idea why the others left their posts?"
He shook his head, scanning the landscape.
"I was a cobbler's son, Nynaeve Sedai. I know not the ways of lords and ladies."
He hesitated.
"Besides, I'm not a borderlander anymore."
The implication was clear. He would protect Rand, no matter what other allegiances tugged at him. A very warder-like way of thought. Nynaeve nodded slowly.
"Do you have any idea what we're riding into?"
"They'll keep their word," Narishma said. "A borderlander would sooner die than break his word. They promised to send a delegation to meet with the Lord Dragon. They'll do just that. I wish we'd been allowed to bring our Aes Sedai, though."
Reports held that the Borderlander army included 13 Aes Sedai, a dangerous number. The number needed to still a woman or gentle a man. 13 women in a circle could shield the most powerful of channelers. Rand had insisted that the delegation that came to meet him include no more than 4 of those 13 Aes Sedai. In return, he promised to bring no more than 4 channelers. 2 Ashaman, Narishma and Naif, Nynaeve, and Rand himself. Maurice and the others had thrown the Aes Sedai equivalent of a fit. It involved a lot of downturned lips, and questions like, "Are you certain you want to do that?" when Rand had forbidden them to come.
Nynaeve noted Narishma's tense posture.
You don't look as if you trust them.
A borderlander's place is guarding the border, Narishma said. I was a cobbler's son, and yet I was trained with the sword, spear, bow, axe, and sling. Even before joining the Ashaman, I could best 4 out of 5 trained southern soldiers in a duel. We lived to defend. And yet they left. Now of all times. With 13 Eyes Sedai.
He glanced at her with those dark eyes of his.
I want to trust them. I know them for good people. But good people can do the wrong thing. Particularly when men who can channel are involved.
Nynaeve fell silent. Narishma had a point, though what cause would the borderlanders have to harm Rand? They'd fought the encroachment of the Blight and its shadow spawn for centuries, and the struggle against the Dark One was imprinted on their very souls. They wouldn't turn against the Dragon Reborn. The borderlanders had a special honor about them. It could be frustrating, true, but it was who they were. Lan's reverence for his homeland, particularly when many other Malkieri had abandoned their identity, was part of what she loved about him.
Oh, Lan, I'll find someone to help you. I won't let you ride into the Shadow's jaws alone.
As they neared a small green hill, several Aiel returned from scouting. Rand pulled the group to a halt, waiting for the Cut-in-Zor-clad scouts to pad up to him, several wearing the red headbands marked with the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai. The scouts weren't winded, despite the fact that they'd run all the way ahead to the meeting place and then back. Rand leaned forward in his saddle.
Did they do as I asked? Did they bring no more than 200 men? No more than 4 Aes Sedai?
Yes, Rand Althor, said one of the scouts. Yes, they kept to your requirements admirably. They have great honor.
Nynaeve recognized the strange Aiel brand of humor in the tone of the man's response.
What? Rand asked. One man, Rand Althor, the Aiel scout said. That is all that their delegation consists of. He's a short little thing of a man, though he looks like he knows how to dance the spears. The crossroads is behind this hill.
Nynaeve looked ahead. Indeed, now that she knew to look, she could see another road running up from the south, presumably meeting with theirs just beyond the hill.
What manner of trap is this? Naif asked, riding up beside Rand, his lean warrior's face concerned. An ambush?
Rand held up a hand for silence. He kicked his gelding into motion, and the scouts kept up without a word of complaint. Nynaeve was nearly left behind. Moonlight was a far more placid animal than she would have chosen for herself. She'd have words with the stable master when she returned to Tyr. They rounded the hillside, finding a dusty square of ground, scarred by old fire pits where caravans had stopped for the night. A roadway smaller than the one they'd been using twisted up to the north and down to the south. A solitary Shinaran man stood in the center, where roads met, watching the oncoming procession. His shoulder-length gray hair hung loose around a lean face which complemented his wiry build. His round face was lined with marks of age. His eyes were small, and he seemed to be squinting.
Hurin? She thought with surprise.
Nynaeve hadn't seen the thief-taker since he'd accompanied her and a group of others back to the White Tower, following the events at Falma. Rand reined in his horse, allowing Nynaeve and the Ashaman to catch up. Aiel fanned out like leaves blown before a gust of wind, taking up watchful positions around the crossroads. She was fairly certain that both of the Ashaman had seized the source, and likely Rand had as well. Hurin shuffled uncomfortably. He looked much as Nynaeve remembered him. A tad more gray in the hair, but wearing the same simple brown clothing, with a sword breaker and a short sword at his waist. He had tied a horse to a fallen log nearby. The Aiel watched it suspiciously, as others might watch a pack of guard dogs.
"Why, Lord Rand!" Hurin called, voice uneven. "It is you. Well, you've certainly come up in the world, I must say.
Good to...
He cut off as he was raised from the ground. He made an irk of surprise, being turned on unseen weaves of air. Nynaeve suppressed a shiver. Would seeing men channel ever stop bothering her?
Who chased after you and me, Huron? Rand called. The time when we were trapped in that distant shadowland. What nationality of men did I fell with the bow?
Men?
Huron asked, voice almost a squawk.
Lord Rand, there were no men in that place. None that we met. Beyond Lady Selene, that is. All I remember are those frog beasts, the same ones folk say those Shanshan ride.
Rand spun Huron around in the air, regarding him with cold eyes. Then he urged his mount closer. Nynaeve and the Ashaman did as well.
You don't believe that I'm me, Lord Rand? Huron asked as he hung in the air.
I take very little as it is presented to me these days, Rand said. I assume the Borderlanders sent you because of our familiarity?
Huron nodded, sweating. Nynaeve felt a stab of pity for the man. He was absolutely devoted to Rand. They had spent a lot of time together, chasing down Fane and the Horn of Valyr. On the return trip to Tarvalen, she'd seldom been able to stop Huron from gossiping about this or that grand feat that Rand had accomplished. Being treated this way by the man he idolized was probably very unsettling for the lean thief-taker.
Why only you? Rand asked quietly.
Well, Huron said, sighing. They did tell you.
He hesitated, seeming distracted by something. He sniffed audibly.
Now that?
That's strange.
Never smelled that before.
What? Rand asked.
I don't know, Huron said. The air. It smells like a lot of death. A lot of violence, only not. It's darker. More terrible.
He shuddered visibly. Huron's ability to smell violence was one of those oddities that the tower couldn't explain. Not something related to the power, yet obviously not quite natural, either. Rand didn't seem to care what Huron smelled.
Tell me why they sent only you, Huron.
I was saying, Lord Rand. See, this here, we're to discuss terms.
Terms regarding your armies moving back where they belong, Rand said.
No, Lord Rand, Huron said uncomfortably. Terms for setting up a real meeting with them. That part in their letter was kind of vague, I guess. They said you might be angry to find only me here.
They were wrong, Rand said, voice softer. Nynaeve found herself straining to hear him, leaning forward.
I no longer feel anger, Huron, Rand said. It serves me no useful function. Why would we need terms to meet together? I presumed that my offer to bring only a small force would be acceptable.
Well, Lord Rand, Huron said, you see, they really want to meet with you. I mean, we came all this way, marched through the bloody winter itself. My pardon, Aes Sedai. But it was the bloody winter. And a bad one, although it took a long time getting to us. Anyways, we did that, coming for you, Lord Rand. So, you see, they want to meet with you, very badly. But, well, last time you were in Farmadding, there was...
Rand held up a finger. Huron quieted and all grew still. Even the horses seemed to hold their breaths.
The Borderlanders are in Farmadding? Rand asked.
Yes, Lord Rand.
They want to meet with me there?
Yes, Lord Rand. You'll have to come inside the protection of the Guardian, you see, and...
Rand waved a curt hand, cutting off Huron. A gateway opened immediately. It didn't appear to lead to Farmadding, however. It just led back a short distance to the road where Rand and the others had been riding a short time before. Rand released Huron, gesturing for the Aiel to let the man mount, then moved Tidaishar through the gateway. What was going on? Everyone else followed. Once through, Rand created another gateway, this one opening into a small wooded hollow. Nynaeve thought she recognized it.
This was where they had camped following their visit to Far Madding with Cadswain. Why the first gateway? Nynaeve thought, confused. And then it occurred to her. One didn't need to learn an area to travel a short distance from it. And traveling to a place taught someone that location well enough to create gateways from it. So by traveling a short hop first, Rand memorized the location well enough to create gateways wherever he wanted, while skipping the time needed to learn the area. It was extremely clever, and Nynaeve felt herself blushing that she hadn't seen the possibility before. How long had Rand known of this trick? Had memory of it come from that voice in his head? Rand rode Tydeishar out into the hollow, the horse's hooves stirring fallen leaves as he worked his way through the underbrush. Nynaeve followed, trying to urge her docile mare to keep up with Rand. That stablemaster was going to hear from her for certain. His ears would burn when she was through with him. Hurin trotted his horse out as well, and the Aiel loped along, subtly keeping him surrounded. They had their faces veiled, spears or bows in hand. Past the trees and underbrush, Rand stopped Tydeishar, looking across the open meadow toward the ancient city of Far Madding. It wasn't large, not by the measure of the great cities, nor was it beautiful, not when compared with the Ogier-built wonders Nynaeve had seen. But it was big enough, and it was certainly home to fine architecture and ancient relics. Set upon an island in a lake, it was actually faintly reminiscent of Tar Valon. Three broad bridges crossed the calm waters and were the only means of entering the city. A very large army was encamped around the lake, perhaps covering more ground than Far Madding itself. Nynaeve counted dozens of different pennons marking dozens of different houses. There were lines upon lines of horses, and tents like rows of summer crops, carefully planted and organized, awaiting harvest. The Borderlander Army.
"I've heard of this place," Nave said, riding up, close-cropped dark brown hair ruffling in the wind.
He narrowed his eyes, rectangular face dissatisfied.
"It's like a steading, only not as safe."
Far Madding's massive Tirangreal, known as the Guardian, created invisible protective bubbles that blocked people from touching the One Power. That could be worked around through the use of a very specialized Tirangreal, one of which Nynaeve happened to be wearing, but it would help only slightly.
The army looked close enough to be within the bubble that prevented men from channeling, which extended about a mile out around the city.
"They will know we've come," Rand said softly, eyes narrowed. "They'll have been waiting for it. They expect me to ride into their box."
"Box?" Nynaeve asked hesitantly.
"The city is a box," Rand said. "The whole city and the area around it. They want me where they can control me, but they don't understand. Nobody controls me. Not anymore. I've had enough of boxes and prisons, of chains and ropes. Never again will I put myself into the power of another."
Still staring at the city, he reached to its place on his saddle and removed the statuette of a man holding aloft a globe. Nynaeve felt a sharp chill. Did he have to bring that with him everywhere he went?
"Perhaps they need to be taught," Rand said, "given encouragement to do their duty and obey me."
"Rand?" Nynaeve tried to think. She couldn't let this happen again. The access key began to glow faintly.
"They want to capture me," he said softly. "Hold me. Beat me. They did it once in Far Madding already. They—"
"Rand!" Nynaeve said sharply. He stopped, looking at her, seeing her as if for the first time. "These are not slaves with their minds already burned away by Grendahl. That is an entire city full of innocent people."
"I wouldn't harm the people of the city," Rand said, voice emotionless. "That army deserves the demonstration, not the city. A rain of fire upon them, perhaps, or lightning to strike and bite."
"They have done nothing other than ask you to meet with them,"
Nynaeve said, edging her horse closer to him. That Terran Greal sat like a viper in his hand. Once it had cleansed the source, if only it had melted away as the female one had. She wasn't certain what would happen if he aimed a weave into the protective bubble of Far Madding, but she suspected it would still work. The Guardian didn't stop weaves from being made. Nynaeve had been able to craft weaves just fine when she'd drawn upon her well. Either way, she knew that she had to stop Rand from turning his anger, or whatever it was he felt, upon his allies. "Rand," she said softly, "if you do this, there will be no turning back."
"There's already no turning back for me, Nynaeve," he said, his eyes intense.
Those eyes shifted, sometimes seeming gray, sometimes blue. Today they looked iron gray. He continued, voice flat.
"My feet started on this path, the moment Tam found me crying on that mountain."
"You don't have to kill anyone today, please." He turned to look back at the city. Slowly, mercifully, the access key stopped glowing.
"Hurin!" he barked.
He must be close to fraying, Nynaeve thought. His anger is slipping out in his voice. The thief-taker rode up to the front of the group. The Aiel kept their distance, however.
"Yes, Lord Rand?"
"Return to your masters inside of their box," Rand said, voice under control again. "You are to give them a message for me."
"What message, Lord Rand?"
Rand hesitated, then slipped the access key back in its place.
"Tell them that it will not be long before the dragon reborn rides to battle at Sheol Ghul. If they wish to return to their posts with honor, I will provide them with transport back to the Blight. Otherwise, they can remain here, hiding. Let them explain to their children and grandchildren why they were hundreds of leagues away from their posts when the Dark One was slain and the prophecies fulfilled."
Hurin looked shaken.
"Yes, Lord Rand."
With that, Rand turned his horse about and rode back toward the clearing. Nynaeve followed, too slowly. Beautiful though moonlight was, she'd have traded the beautiful mare in an instant for a biddable, dependable Two Rivers horse like Bela. Hurin stayed behind. He still looked shaken. His reunion with Lord Rand had obviously been far from what he expected. Nynaeve gritted her teeth as the trees obscured her view of him. Inside the clearing, Rand had opened another gateway, a direct gateway to Tyr. They rode out into the traveling ground prepared outside the Stone of Tyr's stable yards. The air was hot and muggy in Tyr, despite the overcast sky, and thick with the sounds of men training and gulls shrieking. Rand rode out to where stable hands waited, then dismounted, his face unreadable. As Nynaeve climbed off of Moonlight and handed the reins to a ruddy-faced stable worker, Rand walked past her.
"Look for a statue," he said.
"What?" she asked with surprise. He glanced back at her, stopping.
"You asked where Perrin was. He's camped with an army beneath the shade of an enormous fallen statue, shaped like a sword stabbing the earth. I'm certain scholars here can tell you where it is. It's very distinctive."
How do you know that?"
Rand just shrugged. "I just do."
"Why tell me?" she asked, walking alongside him across the yard of packed earth. She hadn't expected him to give up the information. He had gotten into the habit of holding on to whatever he knew, even if that knowledge was meaningless.
"Because," he said, striding toward the keep, voice growing almost too soft to hear, I have a debt to you for caring when I cannot. If you seek Perrin out, tell him that I will soon need him."
With that, he left her. Nynaeve stood in the horse yard, watching him go. There was a wet scent to the air, the smell of new rain, and she could feel that she'd missed a sprinkle.
not enough to clear the air or muddy the ground, but enough to leave wetted sections of stone in shaded corners. To her right, men galloped and exercised horses beneath the dun sky, riding across sandy earth between pickets. The stone was the only fortress she knew of with exercise areas for cavalry, but then the stone was far from ordinary. The rumble of hoofbeats was like the sound of a distant storm, and she found herself glancing northward. The storm there felt closer than it had before. She'd assumed it was gathering in the blight, but now she wasn't so certain. She took a deep breath, then hastened to the keep. She passed defenders in their immaculate uniforms, the upper arm portions ribbed and puffy, breastplates smooth and curved. She passed stable boys, each probably dreaming of one day wearing that same uniform, but for now only leading horses back to the stables for hay and currying. She passed dozens of servants in linens, doubtless far more comfortable than Nynaeve's maroon wool. The keep itself was a towering rock of a structure, sheer walls broken only by windows, except that she could still spot the place where Matt had destroyed a section of stone with his illuminator's fireworks when coming to rescue Nynaeve and the others from their imprisonment. Fool boy. Where was he? She hadn't seen him in quite a long time, since Ebudar had fallen to the Seanchan. In a way, she felt as though she'd abandoned him, though she'd never admit that. Why, she'd embarrassed herself enough in front of the Daughter of the Nine Moons when she'd defended that scoundrel. She still didn't know what had come over her. Matt could care for himself. He was probably carousing in some inn while the rest of them worked to save the world, drinking himself silly and playing at dice. Rand was another matter. He'd been so much easier to deal with when he'd continued to act like other men, stubborn and immature, but predictable. This new Rand with the cold emotions and the cold voice was truly unnerving. The narrow corridors of the stone were still unfamiliar to Nynaeve, and she often got lost. Her disorientation wasn't helped by the fact that hallways and walls sometimes changed places. She'd tried to discount such tales as superstitious nonsense, but the day before, she'd woken to discover that her room had indeed suddenly and mysteriously moved. Her door had opened to a smooth wall of the same seamless rock as the stone itself. She'd been forced to escape through a gateway, and had been shocked to learn that her window looked out from a location 2 stories higher than it had the previous night. Cadswain said it was the Dark One's touch on the world, causing the pattern to unravel. Cadswain said a lot of things, and few of them were things that Nynaeve wished to hear. Nynaeve got lost twice as she wove her way through the corridors, but she eventually arrived at Cadswain's room. At least Rand hadn't forbidden his stewards to grant her rooms. Nynaeve knocked. She'd learned that she'd better. Then entered. The Aes Sedai from Cadswain's group, Maurice and Kareel, sat in the room, knitting and sipping tea, trying to look like they were not waiting on the infernal woman's whims. Cadswain herself was speaking quietly with Min, whom she'd all but appropriated in recent days. Min herself didn't seem to mind, perhaps because it wasn't easy to spend time with Rand these days. Nynaeve felt a stab of sympathy for the girl. Nynaeve only had to deal with Rand as a friend. All this would be much harsher on the one who shared his heart. All eyes turned toward Nynaeve as she closed the door. "I think I've found him," she announced. "Who is that child?" Cadswain said, leafing through one of Min's books. "Perrin," Nynaeve said. "You were right. Rand did know where he was." "Excellent," Cadswain said. "You did well. It appears that you can be of use." Nynaeve wasn't certain which annoyed her more, the backhanded compliment, or the fact that her heart swelled with pride at hearing it. She was no girl without her braid to be stroked by this woman's words. "Well?" Cadswain looked up from the book. The others remained silent, though Min did shoot Nynaeve a congratulatory smile. "Where is he?" Nynaeve opened her mouth to reply before she caught herself. What was it about this woman that made her want to obey? It wasn't the one power or anything to do with it. Catswain simply projected the air of a stern but fair grandmother. The type you never spoke back to, but who would give you some baked sweets in reward for sweeping the floor when told. First, I want to know why Perrin is important. Nynaeve stalked into the room and took the only remaining seat, a painted wooden stool. When she sat, she found herself sitting a few inches below eye level, like a student before Catswain. She almost stood up, but realized that would draw more attention.
"Faw," Catswain said. "You'd hold this knowledge back, even if it means the lives of those you hold dear?"
"I want to know what I've gotten myself into," Nynaeve said stubbornly. "I want to know that this information isn't going to end up hurting Rand further." Catswain snorted.
"You presume to think that I'd hurt the fool boy?" "I'm not going to presume otherwise," Nynaeve snapped. "Not until you tell me what you are doing."
Catswain closed the book, Echoes of His Dynasty, and looked perturbed.
"Will you at least tell me how the meeting with the Borderlanders went?" she asked. "Or is that information held for ransom as well?"
Did she think she'd distract Nynaeve that easily?
"It went poorly, as one might expect," she said. "They've hunkered down outside Far Madding and refused to meet with Rand unless he comes within range of the Guardian, cutting himself off from the source."
"Did he take it well?" Coriel asked from her cushioned bench at the side of the room. She smiled faintly. She seemed to be the only one who thought the changes in Rand were amusing rather than terrifying. But then, she was one of the women who had bonded an Ashaman at practically the first opportunity. "Did he take it well?" Nynaeve repeated flatly. "That depends. Does pulling out that blasted Tarangreal and threatening to rain down fire on the army strike you as taking it well?"
Min paled. Catswain raised an eyebrow. "I stopped him," Nynaeve said, "but just barely. I don't know. It might be getting too late to do anything to change him."
"That boy will laugh again," Catswain said quietly but intensely.
"I didn't live this long to fail now."
"What does it matter?" Coriel said. Nynaeve turned in shock. "Well?" Coriel set down her mending. "What does it matter? We're obviously going to succeed."
"Light," Nynaeve said. "What gave you that idea?"
"We've just spent all afternoon drilling this girl about her visions," Coriel nodded to Min. "They always come true. And she's seen things that obviously can't happen until after the last battle. So we know that Rand is going to defeat the Dark One. The pattern has already decided it. We can stop worrying."
"No," Min said. "You're wrong."
Coriel frowned. "Child, are you saying that you lied about the things you've seen?"
"No," Min said. "But if Rand loses, there is no pattern."
"The girl is correct," Catswain sounded surprised. "What this child sees are weavings in the pattern from a time still distant, but if the Dark One wins, he will destroy the pattern entirely. This is the only way the visions could fail to occur. The same holds for other prophecies and foretellings. Our victory is by no means sure." That stilled the room. They weren't playing at village politics or national dominance. At stake was creation itself.
"Light, can I withhold this information if there's any chance of it helping Lan?"
It wrenched her heart to think of him, and she had few options. In fact, Lan's only hope seemed to rest in the armies Rand could marshal and the gateways his people could form. Rand had to change. For Lan, for them all. And she had no idea what to do other than, unfortunately, to trust Catswain. Nynaeve swallowed her pride and spoke. "Do you know the location of a statue of an enormous sword fallen to the earth as if stabbing it?"
Kuriel and Maurice glanced at each other in confusion.
The hand of the Aman Rukane.
Cadswain turned from Min with a raised eyebrow.
The full statue was never finished, from what scholars can tell. It rests near the Johanna Road.
Perrin is camping in its shadow.
Cadswain pursed her lips. I assumed he would go eastward, toward lands Althor has captured.
She took a deep breath.
All right. We are going for him right now.
She hesitated, then glanced at Nynaeve.
In answer to your question earlier, child, Perrin actually isn't important to our plans.
He isn't? Nynaeve asked.
But Cadswain raised a finger. There are people with him who are vital. One in particular.
Chapter 45. The Tower Stands. Egwene walked slowly through the rebel camp, wearing a crimson gown, its skirts divided for riding. The color raised not a few eyebrows. Considering what the Red Aja had done, these Aes Sedai weren't likely to wear the hue. Even the camp's serving women had noticed, selling their red and maroon dresses or cutting them up for rags. Egwene had asked for the crimson specifically. In the tower, sisters had formed the habit of wearing only their own Aja's color, and the practice had helped fuel the division. While it was good to be proud of your Aja affiliation, it was dangerous to begin assuming that you couldn't trust anyone wearing other colors. Egwene was all Aja's. Today the red symbolized many things to her. The impending reunification with the Red Aja, a reminder of the division that needed to be righted, a sign of the blood that would be spilled, the blood of good men who fought to defend the White Tower, the blood of the dead Aes Sedai, beheaded not an hour ago by Egwene's order. Swan had found her great serpent ring. It felt very good to have it on her finger again. The sky was an iron gray, and the scent of dirt rose into the air, accompanying the bustling motion around the camp. Women hurriedly washed clothing, as if they were late in getting their patrons ready for a festival. Novices ran, literally ran, from lesson to lesson. Aes Sedai stood about with arms folded, eyes ready to burn any who didn't keep up the tempo. They sense the tension of the day, Egwene thought, and can't help but be made anxious by it. The night before, with its attack by the Seanchan, followed by the return of the Amyrlin, who had spent the morning cleansing the Aes Sedai, and now afternoon, and the beating drums of war. She doubted that Bryn's own camp was in such a state. He'd have his men ready for attack. He probably could have assaulted the White Tower at a moment's notice on any given day of the siege. His soldiers would decide this war. Egwene would not have her Aes Sedai riding into battle, wriggling around their oaths not to use the power to kill. They would wait here, to be called only for healing. Or called if the White Tower sisters joined the fight in earnest. Light send that Elida saw wisdom in forbidding that. If the Aes Sedai turned the power against one another, it would be a dark day indeed. Can this day grow any darker? Egwene wondered. Many of the Aes Sedai she passed in the camp gave her looks of respect, awe, and a little horror. After a long absence, the Amyrlin had returned, and she had brought destruction and judgment in her wake. Over 50 black sisters had been stilled, then executed. Egwene felt sick, thinking of their deaths. Shiriam had seemed almost relieved when her turn came, though she'd soon begun to struggle, sobbing and desperate. She'd confessed to several disturbing crimes as if hoping that her willingness to speak would gain her amnesty. They'd placed her head on the block and taken it off, just like the others. That scene would always be vivid in Egwene's mind. Her former keeper, lying with her head pressed against the stump, blue dress and fiery red hair suddenly bathed in warm golden light as a thinner section of clouds moved in front of the sun. Then the silvery axe, falling to claim her head.
Perhaps the pattern would be kinder to her next time she was allowed a thread in its great tapestry, but perhaps not. Death was not an escape from the Dark One. Shiriam's horror at the end indicated that she might have been thinking that very thing as the axe took her head. Now Egwene understood fully how the Aiel could laugh at a simple beating. Would that she could go through a few days beneath the rod, rather than have to order the execution of women she had liked and worked with. Some of the sitters had argued for interrogation instead of execution, but Egwene had been insistent. 50 women were far too many to shield and guard, and now that they knew Stilling could be healed, that wasn't an option. No, history proved how slippery and dangerous members of the Black could be, and Egwene was tired of worrying about what could happen. She had learned with Mogedion that there was a price to be paid for greed, if just greed for information. She and the others had been too eager, too proud of the discoveries they'd made, to see the world rid of one of the Forsaken. Well, she would not allow a similar mistake here. The law was known, the Hall had made its judgment, and it had not been done in secret. Verin had died to stop these women, and Egwene would see that her sacrifice meant something. You did well, Verin. So very well. Every Aes Sedai in the camp had been made to swear the three oaths over again, and only 3 members of the Black had been discovered beyond the ones Verin had located. Her research had been thorough. The Black's warders were under guard. They would have to be sorted through at a later date, when attention could be given to separating those who were really Black from those who were just enraged by the loss of their Aes Sedai. Most of them would seek death, even the innocent ones. Perhaps the innocent could be convinced to remain alive long enough to throw themselves into the last battle. Nearly 20 of the Black sisters on Verin's list had still escaped, despite all of Egwene's precautions. She wasn't certain how they had known. Bryn's guards had caught some weaker ones trying to flee, and soldiers had fallen to delay them, but many had still escaped. No use crying over that. 50 Black were dead. That was a victory. A frightening one, but a victory nonetheless. And so she walked through the camp, in riding boots and a dress of red, brown hair free to stream in the wind and tied with crimson ribbons to mark the streams of blood she had shed not an hour before. She did not blame the sisters around her for their sly glances, their masked concern, their fear, and their respect. If there had been any doubt that Egwene was Amyrlin, it had been dispelled. They accepted her, they feared her, and she would never quite fit in with them again. She was separate, and always would be. A determined figure in blue made her way through the tents and approached Egwene. The dignified woman curtsied appropriately, though since they were walking so quickly, Egwene didn't stop to let her kiss the great serpent ring. Mother, Lilaine said, Bryn sent word that all is at ready for the assault. He says that the western bridges would be the ideal point of attack, though he suggests that gateways be employed to send a flanking force of his men behind the White Tower lines. He asks if this would be possible. It wasn't using the power as a weapon, but it was close. A fine distinction. But being Aes Sedai was about fine distinctions. Tell him I will make the gateway myself, she said. Excellent, Mother, Lilaine said, bowing her head, the perfect, loyal attendant. It was remarkable how quickly the woman's bearing toward Egwene had changed. She must have realized that her only choice was to attach herself to Egwene completely and give up on her attempts to secure power. This way she didn't look like a hypocrite and would perhaps gain position through Egwene, assuming Egwene was able to stabilize herself as a powerful Amyrlin. It was a good assumption. Lilaine must have been frustrated by Ramonda's change of temperament. The yellow waited beside the road ahead, as if on cue. She wore a dress after the color of her Aja, hair back in a stately bun. She curtsied as Egwene reached her and barely spared a glance for Lilaine before falling into position on Egwene's right, away from Lilaine. Mother, Ramonda said, I've made the inquiries you requested. There has been no contact with those sent to the Black Tower.
not a whisper.
"Does this strike you as odd?" Egwene asked.
"Yes, mother.
With traveling, they should have been there and back by now. They should have at least sent word.
This silence is disturbing."
"Disturbing indeed. Even worse, that delegation contained Nisau, Mirel, Faelaine, and Theodrin. Each of the women had sworn fealty to Egwene, an unsettling coincidence. The departure of Faelaine and Theodrin was particularly suspicious. Supposedly they had gone because they had no warders, but the sisters in the camp didn't consider those two full Aes Sedai, though nobody would dare say such to Egwene directly. Why had those four, out of the hundreds of Aes Sedai in the camp, been placed in the delegation? Was it mere coincidence? It stretched plausibility. But what did it mean, then? Had someone intentionally sent away those loyal to Egwene? If so, why not send Swan? Was this perhaps Shiriam's work? The woman had confessed to several things before her execution, but this hadn't been one of them. Either way, something was happening with those Ashaman. The Black Tower would need to be dealt with.
"Mother," Lilaine said, drawing her attention back. The blue didn't glance at her rival.
"I have other news," Romanda sniffed quietly.
"Speak," Egwene said.
"Shiriam wasn't lying," Lilaine said. "The Tirangrial used for dreams are gone. All of them."
"How is this possible?" Egwene demanded, letting a hint of her anger slip out.
"Shiriam was keeper, mother," Lilaine said quickly. "We kept the Tirangrial together, as is custom in the White Tower, under guard. But,
well, what reason would those guards have had to turn Shiriam away?"
"And what do you suppose she was planning to tell us?" Egwene asked. "This theft could not have been kept hidden for long."
"I don't know, mother," Lilaine said, shaking her head. "The guards said that Shiriam seemed flustered when she took the Tirangrial. This was just last night."
Egwene clenched her teeth, thinking of Shiriam's final spilled confessions. The theft of the Tirangrial had been far from the most shocking tidbit she'd mentioned. Elaine would be livid. The original ring had been among those stolen, and Egwene doubted that Swan's hidden copy would be useful as a template. It was already flawed. Copies of it would likely be more imperfect.
"Mother," Lilaine said more softly, "what of Shiriam's other claim?"
"That one of the Forsaken is in the White Tower, impersonating an Aes Sedai?" Egwene said. "Shiriam claimed she'd given the Tirangrial to this person." Lilaine and Romanda walked silently, both staring forward, as if speculation were too daunting.
"Yes, I suspect that she is right," Egwene said. "They infiltrated not only our camp, but the aristocracies of Andor, Ilion, and Tyr. Why not the White Tower as well?"
She didn't add that Varin's book confirmed the presence of one of the Forsaken. It seemed best to keep the extent of Varin's notes secret.
"I wouldn't worry about it too much," Egwene said. "With the assault on the tower and our return, it seems likely that the Forsaken, whoever she is, will find it prudent to slip away and find an easier target for her scheming."
Lilaine and Romanda didn't seem comforted by that comment. The three of them reached the edge of the Aes Sedai camp, where mounts awaited them, as well as a large group of soldiers and one sitter from each of the Ajahs, other than the blue and red. There wasn't a blue, because Lilaine was the only one remaining in camp. The reason there wasn't a red was obvious. This was part of why Egwene had chosen to wear red, a subtle hint that all Ajahs should be represented in the action they were about to take. It was for the good of all. As Egwene mounted, she noticed that Gawain was following her again, at a respectful distance. Where had he come from? They hadn't spoken since the early morning. As she mounted, so did he, and as she turned to ride out of camp with Lilaine, Romanda, the sitters, and the soldiers, Gawain followed at a safe distance. Egwene wasn't certain what to do with him yet. The army camp was mostly deserted. Tents sat empty, ground trampled by feet and hoofs, hardly any soldiers remaining behind. Egwene embraced the source soon after leaving their camp, and she held to it, ready with weaves should someone attack her during the ride.
She still didn't trust that Elida wouldn't use a gateway to interfere with the assault. True, the false Amarlin probably had her hands full with the aftermath of the Shan Shan attack, but expectations like that one, assuming that she was safe, were what had gotten Egwene captured in the first place. She was Amarlin. She couldn't risk herself. It was frustrating, but she knew that an end had come to her days of solitary action, striking out as she saw fit. She could have been killed rather than captured all those weeks ago. The Saladar Rebellion would have floundered, and Elida would have continued as Amarlin. So it was that her force rode up to the battle lines outside the village of Darain. The White Tower still smoldered, a wide field of smoke trailing up in a ring from the center of the island, shrouding the white spire. Even from a distance, the scars of the Shan Shan attack were evident on the building. Blackened holes, like spots of corruption on an otherwise healthy apple. The tower almost seemed to groan as she looked at it. It had stood for so long, had seen so much. Now it had been wounded so deeply that it still bled a day later. And yet it stood. Light, bless them, it stood. It rose high, wounded but sound, pointing toward a sun hidden by clouds above. It stood defiant of those who would break it, within and without. Bryn and Swan waited for Egwene at the back of the army. A disparate couple they were. The battle-hardened general with temples of gray and a face like an unyielding piece of armor, strong, made of lines. And beside him, Swan, the diminutive woman in pale blue, her face lovely, looking young enough to be Bryn's granddaughter, for all the fact that they were near the same age. Swan made a horseback curtsy as Egwene approached, and Bryn saluted. His eyes were still troubled. He seemed ashamed of his part in the rescue, though Egwene bore him no grievance. He was a man of honor. If he had been bullied into coming along to protect foolhardy Swan and Gawain, then Bryn was to be commended for keeping them alive. As Egwene joined them, she noted that Swan and Bryn were riding close together. Had Swan finally admitted her attraction to the man? And there was a certain familiar grace to Bryn now. It was slight enough that she could have just been seeing things, but coupled with the relationship between the two... "You've taken another warder at last?" Egwene asked Swan. The woman narrowed her eyes. "Aye," she said. Bryn did seem surprised and a tad ashamed. "Do your best to keep her out of trouble, General," Egwene said, staring Swan in the eyes. "She has been in quite a bit of it lately. I have half a mind to give her to you to use as a foot soldier. I believe that the military organization might be good for her, and remind her that sometimes obedience overrides initiative." Swan wilted, glancing away. "I haven't decided what to do with you yet, Swan," Egwene said in a softer voice. "But my anger has been kindled, and my trust has been lost. You will need to soothe the first and stoke the second if you wish to enter my confidence again." She turned from Swan to the general, who looked sick, probably from being forced to feel Swan's shame. "You are to be commended for your bravery, letting her bond you, General," Egwene said, turning to Bryn. "I realize that keeping her from trouble is a nearly impossible charge, but I have confidence in you." The general relaxed.
"I shall do my best, Mother," he said.
Then he turned his horse, glancing along the rows of soldiers.
"There is something you should see, if you will."
She nodded, turning her horse and riding beside him down the roadway. The village was cobbled here, the population evacuated, the main thoroughfare lined with thousands of Bryn's soldiers. Swan accompanied Egwene, and Gawain followed. Lilaine and Ramanda stayed with the other sitters at a wave of Egwene's hand. Their newfound obedience was proving useful, particularly since they had apparently decided that they would now be trying to outdo one another for Egwene's approval. Likely they were both vying to be her new keeper, now that Shiriam was gone. The general led Egwene to the front lines, and Egwene prepared a weave of air just in case an arrow was shot in her direction. Swan eyed her but said nothing at the precaution.
It shouldn't have been needed. Tower guards would never fire on an Aes Sedai, not even in a conflict like this one. However, the same couldn't be said of warders, and accidents did happen. It would be very convenient for Elida if a stray arrow took her rival in the throat. The cobbles on the roadway gave way to square paving blocks as they passed through Darain, and those gave way to marble squares leading into the Elendair Bridge, a majestic white construction that spanned the river to Tar Valon. Here was the thing Bryn wanted her to see, gathered on the other side of the bridge, bunkered down behind a blockade of stones and large logs, was a force of Tower Guard, the flame of Tar Valon on their tabards, and there couldn't be more than 1,000 of them. Bryn's assault force here was 10,000 strong.
"Now, I know it was never numbers that were keeping us from attacking," Bryn said, "but the Tower Guard should be able to field more men than that, particularly with conscriptions out of the city proper. I doubt they've been spending these months carving pegs by the fire and reminiscing about old times. If Chubane has half a mind, he's been training a new set of recruits."
"So where is everyone?" Egwene asked.
"Light only knows, Mother," Bryn said, shaking his head. "We'll lose some men getting past that force, but not many. It will be a rout."
"Could the Shan Shan have really hurt them that much?"
"I don't know, Mother," Bryn said. "It was bad last night. A lot of fire. A lot of men dead. But I'd have pegged the cost at hundreds, not thousands. Perhaps the Tower Guard is clearing out rubble and stopping the fires, but I still think they'd have gathered a larger force when they saw me forming up here. I've taken a spyglass to those lads over there, and I've noted more than one set of bleary red eyes."
Egwene sat thoughtfully, glad for the breeze blowing in along the river from downstream. "You haven't questioned the wisdom of this assault, General?"
"It's not my habit to question where I'm pointed, Mother."
"And your thoughts on the matter, if asked?"
"If asked," Bryn said. "Well, attacking makes tactical sense. We've lost traveling as an edge, and if our enemy can resupply at will and send envoys in and out whenever they want, then what's the purpose of a siege? It's time to either attack or pack up and leave."
Egwene nodded, and yet she found herself hesitating. That ominous smoke in the sky, the maimed tower, the frightened soldiers without reinforcements, it all seemed to whisper a warning. "How long can we wait before you absolutely must begin this assault, General?" she asked. He frowned, but didn't question her. He glanced at the sky.
"It's getting late. An hour, perhaps? After that, it will be too dark. With numbers this favorable, I'd rather not add the randomness of a night battle to the mix."
"We wait, then, for an hour," Egwene said, settling back on her mount. The others seemed confused, but they said nothing. The Armalyn seat had spoken. What was she waiting for? What were her instincts telling her? Egwene thought on it as the minutes extended, eventually realizing what had made her pause. Once this step had been taken, there was no turning back. The White Tower had suffered the previous night. It was the first time an enemy force had used the One Power against it. Egwene's assault would be another first, the first time one group of Aes Sedai had led troops in battle against another group. There had been fights between factions in the tower before, clashes between one Aja and another, some turning to bloodshed, like what had happened after Swan's ousting. The secret histories mentioned such events. But never had the dissension extended beyond the doors of the tower itself. Never had Aes Sedai led troops across those bridges. To do so now would attach the event forever to Egwene's tenure as Amyrlin. Whatever else she achieved, it would likely be overshadowed by this day. She had hoped to liberate and unite. Instead, she would turn to war and subjugation. If it had to be so, then she would give the command, but she wanted to wait until the last possible moment. If that meant a grim hour beneath the overcast sky, horses snorting as they sensed their riders' tension, then so be it. Bryn's hour came and passed. Egwene hesitated for a few minutes longer, as long as she dared,
No relief came to the poor soldiers on the other side of the bridge. They just stared out behind their little barricade, resolute. Reluctantly, Egwene turned to give the command.
Here now. Bryn leaned forward in his saddle. What is this?
Egwene turned back to the bridge. Distantly, just barely visible, a procession was coming down the road. Had she waited too long? Had the White Tower sent reinforcements? Had she cost the lives of her men by her stubborn reluctance? But no. That group wasn't soldiers, but women in skirts.
Aes Sedai.
Egwene held up her hand, staying any attacks by her soldiers. The procession rode directly up to the Tower Guard fortification. A moment later, a woman in a gray dress stepped out in front of the roadblock, accompanied by a single warder. Egwene squinted, trying to make out the woman's features, and Bryn hastily handed her his spyglass. Egwene accepted it thankfully, but had already recognized the woman. Andaya Foray, one of the new sitters to the hall chosen after the split. Gray Aja, that implied a willingness to negotiate. The glow of power surrounded the woman, and Swan hissed, causing several nearby soldiers to raise their bows. Again, Egwene held up a hand.
Bryn, she said sternly. I will not have the first shot fired until I give permission.
Stand down, men, Bryn bellowed. I'll have your hides if you so much as knock an arrow.
The men snapped their bows back down from the ready. The distant woman used a weave Egwene couldn't make out, and then spoke in a voice that was obviously amplified.
We would speak with Egwene Alvear, Andaya said. Is she in attendance?
Egwene made her own weave to amplify her voice.
I am here, Andaya. Tell the others with you to come out so that I can see them.
Surprisingly, they obeyed the command. 9 more women filed out, and Egwene studied each one. 10 sitters, she said, handing Bryn back his spyglass and releasing her weave so that she could speak without her words being projected. 2 from each Aja except the blue and the red.
That's promising, Bryn rubbed his chin.
Well, they could be here to demand my surrender, Egwene noted. All right, she said, amplifying her voice with the power again. What do you wish of me?
We have come, Andaya said. She hesitated.
We have come to inform you that the Hall of the White Tower has chosen to raise you to the Ammerlin seat.
Swan gasped in shock, and Bryn cursed quietly to himself. Several of the soldiers muttered about it being a trap. But Egwene just closed her eyes. Dared she hope? She'd assumed that her unwanted rescue had come too soon, but if she'd laid enough groundwork before being taken by Swan and Gawain...
What of Elida? Egwene demanded, opening her eyes, her voice booming across the expanse. Have you deposed yet another Ammerlin?
The other side was silent for a moment.
They're conferring.
Bryn had raised his spyglass. Andaya spoke a moment later.
Elida do Avrinia Royhan, Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalen, the Ammerlin Seat, was taken in the raid last night. Her whereabouts are unknown. She is presumed dead or otherwise unable to fulfill her duties.
By the light!
Bryn lowered the glass. No more than she deserved, Swan muttered.
No woman deserves that, Egwene said to Swan and Bryn.
Absently, she raised fingers to her neck.
Better she had died.
Bryn said, this could be a trap.
I don't see how, Swan said.
Andaya is bound by the oaths. She wasn't on your list of black, was she, Egwene? Egwene shook her head.
I'm still hesitant, Mother, Bryn said.
Egwene restored her weave.
You will let my army enter? You will accept the other Aes Sedai back in fellowship and will reinstate the blue Aja?
We anticipated these demands, Andaya said. They will be met.
There was silence. The only sound that of the waters lapping against their banks below.
Then I accept, Egwene said across the bridge.
Mother, Swan said cautiously. This might be rash,
Perhaps you should speak with It Is Not Rash.
Egwene released her weave and felt a surge of hope.
It is what we've wanted.
She eyed Swan.
Besides, who are you to lecture me on being rash?
Swan looked down.
General, prepare your men to cross, and bring the sitters at the back forward. Send runners back to the Aes Sedai camp with the news, and make certain your men at the other bridges know to stand down.
Yes, mother.
Bryn wheeled his horse about and gave the necessary orders. Taking a deep breath, Egwene kicked her horse into motion onto the bridge. Swan muttered a fisher's curse and followed. Egwene could hear Gawain's horse following as well, then a squad of soldiers obeying a curt command from Bryn. Egwene rode across the waters, hair blowing out behind her, laced with red ribbons. She felt an odd sense of moment, a weight of realization, as she considered what they had all just avoided. It was soon replaced with growing satisfaction and joy. Her white mare bucked her head slightly, brushing a silky mane across Egwene's hands. On the other side of the bridge, the sitters waited, solemn. The tower rose just ahead, wounded, bleeding. But it still stood. Light! It stood!
Chapter 46. To be forged again. After crossing the bridge to Tar Valon as a victor, the day nearly became a blur for Egwene. She hastened to the White Tower, Swan and Gawain barely managing to keep up with her. At the tower, Egwene was met by a group of servants. The sitters themselves were waiting in the hall for Egwene. The servants led her to an unadorned, wood-paneled chamber set with a pair of leather-padded chairs. Egwene had never been here before. It appeared to be a kind of waiting room near the hall. It smelled of leather, and a small brazier burned coals in the corner. Soon, a short, toad-like brown sister named Lyraine entered and instructed Egwene on the proper way to go about the ceremony. The little curly-haired woman seemed completely indifferent to the importance of the moment, and Egwene had never met her before. Likely, she was one of the Browns who spent her life roaming the back library stacks, and only surfaced once a century or so to recite instructions to prospective Ommerlands. Egwene listened carefully. She'd gone through the ceremony once, but it was very complex. She could still remember her nervousness on that day months ago when she'd been raised in Saladar. Back then, she'd still been confused as to what was happening. Her? Ommerlin? That hesitation was gone. She did not really worry about getting the ceremony wrong. It was only a ceremony, and the important decision had already been made. As Egwene listened to Lyraine, she heard Swan arguing outside the doors with one of the sisters, claiming that Egwene had already been raised and that this ceremony wasn't needed. Egwene quieted Lyraine with a raised hand and called out to Swan. Swan peeked in the door.
I was raised by the rebels, Swan, Egwene said sternly. These women deserve the chance to stand for me as well. Otherwise, I will never have a claim to their loyalty. The ceremony must be performed again.
Swan scowled, but nodded.
Very well.
Lyraine opened her mouth to continue instructions, but Egwene silenced her with another motion, earning a huff.
What news have you, Swan?
Well, Swan said, cracking the door a little wider. Bryn moved most of his troops across the bridges, and has relieved the tower guard from their positions at the fortifications, sending them in, along with a number of his own squads, to help put out flare-ups around the city. The Shan Chan set some homes on fire to cover their retreat as they fled. That explained the lack of troops at the barricade. That, along with the knowledge that the hall was busy debating whether or not to raise Egwene, they likely didn't realize how close they'd come to war.
What do you want to do with the sisters from your camp? Swan asked.
They're starting to wonder.
Tell them to gather in front of the sunset gate, Egwene said. Have them stand in ranks by Aja with sitters in a line at the front. Once I am finished with the ceremony, I will greet them and formally accept their apology for their rebellion and welcome them back into the tower.
Accept their apology? Swan asked incredulously.
They rebelled against the Tower Swan, Egwene said, looking at her. Whatever the need of what they did, there is reason for apology.
But you were with them.
I no longer represent just them, Swan, Egwene said firmly. I represent the Tower, the entire Tower, and the Tower needs to know that the rebels regret the division. They needn't lie and say that they wished they had stayed, but I think it is appropriate for them to express sorrow over the hardships the division caused. I will acquit them, and we can get on with healing.
Yes, Mother, Swan said in resignation.
Egwene caught sight of Tassan standing behind, the woman nodding her Tarabonner braided head at Egwene's words. Egwene let Lyraine continue her instructions, then repeated back to her the lines she would have to say and the actions she'd have to take. When the Brown was satisfied, Egwene rose, pulled open the door, and found that Swan had left to relay her orders. Tassan stood in the hallway outside, arms folded, regarding Gawain. He leaned against the wall a short distance away, his hand resting on the pommel of his sheathed sword.
"Your warder?" Tassan asked of Egwene.
She regarded Gawain and was forced to confront a whole mess of emotions. Anger, affection, passion, and regret. What a strange mix.
"No," she said.
She stared Gawain in the eyes. "What I am going to do next you cannot be part of, Gawain. Wait here." He opened his mouth to object, thought better of it, then stood up stiffly and bowed. That gesture felt even more insolent than an argument would have. Egwene sniffed softly, yet loud enough for him to hear, then allowed Tassan to lead her to the hall of the tower. The hall. Both a place and a group of people. For they were one, just as the Ammerlin seat was a person, yet was also the chair in which she sat. She stopped before the doors to the hall, the dark wood inlaid with the silver flame of Tarvalin, and felt her heart flutter rebelliously. Swan suddenly appeared with a pair of slippers, gesturing at Egwene's riding boots. Of course, the hall floor was delicately painted. She changed into the slippers. Swan took her boots away. There was no need to be nervous. "I've been here before," she thought suddenly. "Not just in Saladar. In my testing. I've faced this door, confronted the women beyond. In my testing." A gong suddenly sounded. It seemed loud enough to shake the entire tower, ringing to warn that an Ammerlin was about to be raised. The gong rang again, then again, and those ornate doors swung open. Yes, this was a different experience entirely from the one she'd had back in that humble wooden building where she'd been raised by the Saladar Aes Sedai. In many ways, her performance in Saladar had been but a rehearsal. The doors finished opening, and Egwene stifled a gasp. The grand, domed room beyond now had a blasted hole, a gaping emptiness directly across from the entrance. It looked out at Dragonmount. The chamber wasn't as damaged as some had been in the Shanxian attack. The rubble was minimal, and the destruction had barely reached past that outer wall. The raised platform still ran around the outside of the room, and the chairs it held were undamaged. 18 of them, in clusters of three, each painted and cushioned to declare the Aja of its inhabitant. The Ammerlin seat stood by the far wall, directly in front of the broken wall, its back to the sprawling landscape beyond and distant Dragonmount. If the Shanxian blast had gone a few feet farther inward, the seat would have been destroyed. Thank the light it was unmarred. Egwene could faintly smell paint in the air. Had they hurriedly had the seat repainted to bear all seven colors again? If so, they'd worked quickly. They hadn't had time to replace the seats of the blue sitters, however. Egwene noted Saeron, Doasin, and Yukiri sitting with their respective Ajas. Siain was there as well, regarding Egwene with those calculating blue eyes. How much power had these four women wielded in these events? Round-faced Swana of the Yellow was smiling openly in satisfaction as she regarded Egwene, and while most of the faces bore the serene, unemotional faces of Aes Sedai,
Egwene sensed approval in their postures, or at least a lack of hostility. More than just the Black Aja hunters had been behind this decision. Saren stood up from her chair in the brown section. "Who comes before the Hall of the Tower?" she asked in a ringing voice. Egwene hesitated, still looking over the sitters, their seats arranged around the outer platform, equally spaced. Too many of those chairs were empty. There were only two green sitters. Talene had fled weeks ago. The Greys were missing Evanaline, who had vanished earlier in the day. Velina and Sidora were gone as well. That didn't bode well. Those two were on Varen's list of Black Aja. Had they been warned? Did Evanaline's disappearance mean Varen had missed her? There were no red sitters, either. With a start, Egwene remembered that Duhara had left the tower some weeks before. Nobody knew why, but some said it had been on a mission for Elida. Perhaps she was about Black Aja business. The other two red sitters, Javindra and Pavara, had vanished mysteriously. That left 11 sitters. Not enough to raise an Ammerlin by the old laws of the tower, but those had been revised with Elida's disbanding of the Blue. Fewer sitters meant fewer women needed to raise an Ammerlin, and now only 11 were required. It would have to do. At least each and every sitter currently in the tower knew of this event. It wasn't in secret, like Elida's raising, and Egwene could be reasonably certain no black sitters would stand for her. Saren cleared her throat, glancing at Egwene uncertainly, and called again, "Who comes before the Hall of the Tower?" Tassan leaned in from the side, as if to hiss the proper response to Egwene. Egwene, however, cut her off by holding up a hand. There was something Egwene had been considering, something audacious, yet it was appropriate. She knew that it was. She could feel that it was. "The Red Aja is in disgrace?" she asked quietly of Tassan. The White nodded, braided hair brushing the sides of her face. "The Reds, you needn't worry about them," she said in her light Tarabonner accent. "Following Elida's disappearance, they retreated back to their own quarters. The sitters here, they worried that the Red would choose new sitters quickly and send them to this proceeding. I believe some curt missives from the Hall of the Tower were enough to cow them."
"And Sylviana Brehan? Still imprisoned?"
"She is, as far as I know, Mother," Tassan said, slipping for a moment and using the title, though Egwene hadn't been formally raised by the Hall yet. "Don't worry. Lyanna, she has been freed. We had her escorted out to stand with the other rebels, awaiting your forgiveness." Egwene nodded thoughtfully. "Have Sylviana brought here to the Hall of the Tower immediately." Tassan's brow wrinkled. "Mother, I don't think this is the time." "Just do it," Egwene hissed, then turned to face the Hall. "One who comes obediently, in the light," she pronounced in a firm voice. Saren relaxed. "Who comes before the Hall of the Tower?" "One who